Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon.
Good morning. Brother Cook mentioned that some notes up here. I put these up here as a reminder to myself that when you leave this morning, there are outlines of this morning's lesson that are available for you on the way out, along with a discussion guide. You could use that discussion guide in a lot of different ways. You could make paper airplanes out of them. You could, you know, shoot baskets at your trash can. If there's a better use, I'm persuaded, for them than that. You can come back tonight. And tonight we begin a new round of discussion groups that are sort of age-oriented. So we have some sort of a discussion group for people in your age category that's going to be going on in alternative locations throughout the building. The opportunities that we envision for this are for us to get a little bit deeper into what we consider this morning in this morning's lesson, to do so in a relational format where we're getting to know and learn from and give to other people in a smaller group environment. So we really want to encourage as much participation in that as possible. And if you want to help prepare yourself for that discussion, then grab one of these on your way out this morning. We are in the middle of a series of lessons on happiness and its relationship with holiness. And the reality is that if we want to be happy, if we want to harvest happy, we've got to sow holy. We've got to sow holy. Last week, we saw that nothing makes you happy. Remember that? Nothing makes you happy. No thing makes you happy, because people were not created to be made happy by things, but through meaningful relationships. First and foremost, our relationship with God, our Maker, and then secondly, through quality relationships with other people. When we love God first and love other people as ourselves and love our neighbor as ourselves, we open ourselves up to the means by which God brings happiness into the heart, happiness into our lives. This morning, we want to focus on a question, and I really want to draw your attention to the screen and ask you to think about this question very, very carefully. It's an important question. What is the relationship between holiness and happiness? What is the relationship between holiness and happiness? Our theme this year is holiness. I know for some of you that's not a common word. For most of us, it's not a word we use day in and day out. We may even wonder exactly what that means. It means to be ultimately set apart. It means to be set apart in a special way for God and to God. It means to be uncommon in a lot of ways, but we think of it in terms of being a godly person, a moral person, a person who's striving to live ethically and morally pure or clean. These are some of the ideas that come with the concept of holiness, being set apart, devoted to, loyal to God. So what's the relationship between that and actually being a happy person? How would you answer that question? You know, if you are a religious kind of person, a person maybe that's grown up in church and you've thought about these things for a while, one of the answers that you might give, this was the answer that people gave when Jesus walked the earth. The religious people, you may think about the Pharisees, for instance, that are so well known to most of us, they would have said, well, this is the relationship that they have. If I want to be happy, if I want to be holy, rather, I need to give up happy. If I have to give up happiness in order to be holy, that's the way that a religious person tends to think. Not all people, but a lot of religious people, and certainly the religious people that Jesus encountered, tended to think, if I want to be happy, I need to give up holy. They're incompatible. If you're a non-religious person, and some of you may be here visiting, some of you may not have much of a church background, and you're sort of looking at it, and you see the same kind of thing, but you sort of see it from the opposite direction, don't you? You say, I have to give up holiness to have happiness. And I'm really into happiness, and so I'm willing to give up the religion thing. I'm willing to give up the holy thing. I'm willing to give up the godliness thing, because what I want is to simply be happy. Jesus says something that turns both of these around, that turns all of this upside down. And this is why all of us, whether we have religious backgrounds and consider ourselves religious people, or whether we don't have that background and don't consider ourselves religious, we really, really ought to be reading the words of Jesus, because he challenges everyone's thinking. When Jesus walked this earth, he challenged the thinking of those that were termed the sinners, and he challenged the thinking of those who were the religious. And in this instance, basically, I want to summarize what I think Jesus is going to say and the things that we're going to consider this morning. He says, if you want happiness, and really, who doesn't? I mean, you might sort of in your pious way say, oh, I've given up on happiness because I want holiness. And God doesn't care about being happy. He only cares about us being holy. So I've given up on happy in pursuit of holy. But the reality is you want to be happy. And you're seeking it in one way or another. Maybe through religion you're finding that is a way that you can pursue happiness. But Jesus recognizes that. And Jesus is going to say to us, as we will see in just a moment, that if you want happiness, you must pursue holiness. This isn't optional. That the happiest people and the holiest people are not two different categories, but the truth of the matter is they are one and the same. We can put it this way, and this is the big idea that we're going to drive all through the lesson. To harvest happiness, I must sow holiness. To harvest happiness, I must sow holiness. Because happiness is an outcome. Happiness is a result that comes from doing something else. And what we're going to see is that if we sow godliness, if we sow righteousness, if we sow holiness, we can reap happiness. Jesus shows us that that's the case in the Beatitudes. So if you have your Bible and you want to follow along there, turn to Matthew chapter 5, or you look it up on your phone, or you can follow along. I'm going to put each of these verses on the screen. But this is the beginning. This is Jesus' introduction to his most famous sermon. It's a sermon that he preached several times, we can tell, throughout his ministry. He repeated this content in a variety of settings. But he begins it by talking about these Beatitudes, they're typically called, these blessed states of being or ways of thinking and ways of acting. And we don't use the word blessed very much. If you look up Strong's, which is a Greek dictionary, or Thayer's Greek dictionary, one of the first things they'll tell you is blessedness means happiness. Now, we sometimes shy away from using the word happiness, though some translations do, because we are afraid that people are going to get the connotation of just sort of that shallow, happy-clappy idea, and that's not what Jesus is talking about. So don't think of happiness in that way. He's thinking about that real happiness that all of us are seeking, that you're looking for, that has to do with being at peace within, that has that real and abiding joy that even though the circumstances around you may be adverse and you're going through some really hard trials, you still have that calmness, you still have that peace, you still have this abiding joy and hope. That's the kind of happiness that we're talking about. And that's what Jesus means when he says blessed. So happy in this real, robust, profound way, happy are the poor in spirit. He's going to do this 8 times. He's going to give us 8 of these blessed attitudes. And the first is here, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, that's counterintuitive. And Jesus isn't saying here that there is some moral excellence in being poor. He's not saying that poverty is the morally superior state to be in. He's talking about a poverty of spirit. And Jesus realizes, he uses this analogy because Jesus realizes that poor people understand something that rich people tend to forget. Poor people know one thing at least that most rich people tend to forget. Do you know what it is? Poor people know that they are absolutely dependent upon God for everything. A person who's truly impoverished knows that he is a dependent person. A person who begins to get along in life pretty well, a person who begins to rise up and things become a little bit easier, not living week to week or day to day, as those who are truly poor would, you begin to think that you've got this. I've got this figured out. I can handle it. I can do all this on my own. And we lose that sense of our dependence upon God, and we stop looking to Him for provision and for guidance in life. And the more we do that, while we think we're doing okay, the further and further we're drifting away from the true source of our happiness, which is that relational dependence upon God for everything. One way especially that we have to be dependent upon God and realize that dependence upon God is for guidance in making choices. Guidance for making choices. You know, we begin to accumulate some wealth and begin to become pretty confident in our decision-making process. I do pretty good. I don't need to listen to God. I've got this figured out. But we need God's guidance, and I need to realize that I'm as dependent upon God today as I ever have been. And the Bible tells us that there's a way that seems right to a man, but the ends of it are the ways of death. There's a way that looks good to me. Here's a decision, and that's the way I think I ought to go, and I simply go the way I want to go. I'm not dependent upon God. I'm not listening to God. I'm doing it the way I want to do it, and it seems right. It seems like this is going to lead to happiness. Seems like this is going to lead to well-being. But the end of that pathway, so often, when we disregard God, ends up in disaster. There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is the ways of death. And so we need to be dependent upon God. We need to be poor in spirit, humbling ourselves before Him and saying, I depend upon You as much today as I ever, ever have. And God's wisdom is found in God's Word. And so we need to trust what God says, not our gut. We need to be not rich in our opinion of ourselves, but poor in our spirit so that we humble ourselves enough to listen to the guidance that God gives. He also tells us in the next verse, this is verse 4, Matthew 5 and verse 4, He says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Now this one, do you catch what Jesus is doing? He's turning things upside down. He's saying, happiness isn't actually found the way that most people think it is. It's not the direct path between I'm just going to go get some happiness that we think. Because what do? If I want to be blessed, if I want to be blessed, if I want to be truly happy, the last thing I want to do is mourn. The last thing I want to do is cry. The last thing I want to do is go to a funeral. The last thing I want to do is deal with the brokenness and the sin that's in my life. Those things bring me down. Those things trouble me. So, you know, what's the next thing on Netflix? What's another video that I can pull up on YouTube? What's the next laugh line that's going to take my mind off of my problems? Because that's the way to happiness we think. Jesus says, no, you need to think a little again. You need to think a little deeper. Happy are the sad. Happy are those who can cry. Happy are those who mourn because they acknowledge their own sin and that we live in a broken world. They're not trying to deny it. They're not trying to mask it with their music. They're embracing it. They're acknowledging it because here's the point. This is why Jesus is so brilliant. Isn't it true that the only way we can ever receive God's comfort and healing is when we've been willing to acknowledge to Him and bewail our sinfulness and our brokenness. As long as I'm avoiding all of that, I may be superficially happy at the moment, but deep down I know I am hurting profoundly. But those who mourn, those who can see this truth, this acknowledge and embrace this reality, are actually on a pathway to joy. And not only in acknowledging this ourselves and being able to weep over our own failures and shortcomings and brokenness, but also to be able to come alongside others in their experience of grief. The ability not to run away from the people that are having trouble and who are sad and who are mourning, but to be able to come alongside them and walk with them. You know, Jesus is described as a man of sorrows acquainted with grief. And not only because He had His own problems that He had to deal with, but because He was so attached and emotionally engaged with other people and their pain and suffering that He was actually able to empathize with them and weep with those who weep, as well as rejoice with those who rejoice. You know, there's always somebody weeping. There's always somebody rejoicing. And the two do not necessarily cancel themselves out. That's the amazing thing about the kind of joy and happiness that Jesus is leading us to, is that it's not that you're either happy or sad at the moment. You can actually have both. Paul the Apostle talks about this. He says, I have a continuing burden and deep grief in my heart over my fellow men who are walking down that path to destruction. And yet he's the same one who says, writing from prison, rejoice always. And again, I say rejoice. So an unremitting sorrow and burden and weight as we mourn over our own sins and the plight of other people, but at the same time, a joy that God gives us, and the joy ultimately conquers the unhappiness. Because the hope and the enduring quality of the relationship that we're forging with God through acknowledging these things is giving us a joy that this world can't take away. The third thing that Jesus calls our attention to is meekness. Now, this would have to be on the bottom of our list of priorities. If you're looking for you don't want your wife to marry another man. If you're looking for your daughter to get married, and you're thinking, what are the list of qualities that I want my daughter to find in a man? Meek is probably not at the top of your list, but maybe it ought to be. Because meekness, it has to do kind of with self-control, but it really has more to do with self-perspective. It has to do with seeing ourselves as we really are and acting accordingly. You know how we are all tempted to see ourselves? I know this is true about almost all of us. It's true about me. I see myself as the main actor in the play. I see myself as the leading role. I see myself as, you know, the person that everything else and everyone else is there to play a supporting role for. I'm the hero of the plot. It's my story. It's so easy for us to become this sort of self-centered person. The next thing we start doing is using everyone around us to support us. Everyone's there to make us look good. We're in the spotlight. We're placing all these demands on everyone else to do these things for us, to recognize our central role in the play, and our relationships are falling apart as a result. But the meek person knows that he is a part of God's plan. He knows he's a part of God's purpose, but he also knows he's not the center of God's plan and purpose. And once you realize that, then you can begin to learn to play second fiddle sometimes. And you don't have to push and have your way all the time. You can come along and help somebody else along the way. And the happy people have those relationships that are long-term and healthy because they are not demanding everyone to focus on them. And Jesus goes on and tells us the next one that I think is one of the most important. At least it resonates with me. He says, blessed and happy are those who hunger and thirst for happiness. Is that what it says? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for happiness, for they shall find happiness. No, blessed are those who are hungry and thirsty to do the right thing. They will be satisfied. How are you going to satisfy the deepest cravings of your heart? Jesus tells us it's by doing the right thing. Consistently, over and over again, you're hungry to do what is right. Here's the ironic thing. If you make happiness the priority, if you seek happiness above all else, you prioritize happiness over holiness, here's what you get. Neither. But if you make holiness the priority, you get both. Those who put righteousness first, doing the right thing consistently, they are the ones who ultimately find satisfaction in life. Now, if happiness becomes our top priority, you know this is true. If happiness becomes your top priority, what do you begin to do? In the moment, in the heat of the moment, you'll cheat. Because that's what's necessary to make the grade, to get into the program that I'm wanting to get into and have the career I'm wanting to have. And so I need to compromise my standard of righteousness in this instant in order to get the happiness that I'm after. Or I will tell a lie in this moment because I don't want to suffer the consequences of dealing with the reality of who I am or what I've done. So I'll change this reality. I'll spin things to make me look better. And I'll make that compromise with my moral standards in order to pursue my happiness. And so we leave holiness behind us to pursue our happiness. And what happens? What's the result? Misery. We've shattered our integrity. We've lost our self-respect. We've harmed our relationship with God. We can't look the people in the eye that we've lied to or cheated because we know we're wrong. And all the things we've been doing because I thought this is the way I could get happy, Jesus is saying it's exactly the opposite. You've got to be willing to sacrifice your temporal happiness in order to do the right thing, in order to fully be satisfied and blessed. Isn't it amazing how Jesus just tells us the truth? And isn't it also true that the things that have robbed you of joy more than anything else in your life are the things that you look back on and know you did the wrong thing. You did the wrong thing. Those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, they're the ones who find satisfaction. But here's another one. Jesus just keeps giving us one great point after another. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. These are the relationally generous. The relationally generous. People who can give another person in their life a break. Can you do that? Can you give your husband a break? You know, as Paul said at the introduction, you know, I thought being married would make me happy. I thought a husband would make me happy. But now this guy's driving me crazy. Sometimes we need to learn to be a little more relationally generous and have mercy on other people. To extend to them the thing that we know we need ourselves. In fact, Jesus says, the thing about the merciful is they're the ones who've opened themselves up to what? To receive mercy. And we all need it. These are the people who don't hold grudges. These are the people who figure out a way to let it go. These are the people who don't demand that you say you're sorry, that you grovel at my feet. Then we'll see about forgiveness moving forward. These are people who have freely received and freely give. They're the relationally generous. But Jesus tells us even more. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. I think of all 8 of these attitudes Jesus goes over, this one is the most vital for us today. So if you've drifted away a little bit, focus back in on this. And what does he say? Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Now I know that America is obsessed with purity. Isn't that true? America is obsessed with purity in our drinking water and in our air quality. We will not settle for contamination. If we turn on the faucet and we get brown water running out, we're not having it. We want clean water. We want pure air. We demand purity in all of those things. But when it comes to moral and ethical purity, sexual purity, we as Americans actively mock it. We think that's ridiculous. We want experience is what we want. We think that experience is the thing that's going to help me make the most of my life and see things clearly. But the reality is that experience, the wrong kind of experience, muddles us. Sin confuses us. Sin contaminates our ability to think clearly and make the best decisions possible. Let me ask you this question. Do you often find yourself looking back, whether it's a few hours, a few days, weeks, months, maybe even years sometimes, but you look back and you ask yourself the question, you find yourself repeatedly asking this kind of question, why did I do that? Why didn't I see what was coming? Why did I lack the moral clarity to see that the path I was choosing was going to end in destruction? Why couldn't I see then what I now so clearly understand? And the problem is we don't see God, we're not looking for God, and we don't see things from God's perspective. We are lacking perspective because we don't see clearly, because we don't have a vision of God or God's vision of ourselves and the world around us. Why didn't I see what was coming? Why did I call her back? Why did I choose to move in with him? Couldn't I see it coming? Why did I buy that? Why didn't I just get up and leave that situation? Why couldn't I, in that moment, have the clarity that I need now? Well, purity clarifies our thinking process. When we want to see God and we want to see things from God's point of view more than anything else, we will have clarity of vision and we will make wise choices. Those who are determined to satisfy their desires, who want something more than God, are going to constantly be confused and muddled and lacking clarity to make those kinds of good choices. They're constantly consigning themselves to the regret of looking back and say, why didn't I see? Why didn't I see? And Jesus could help us change course in our country in so many areas if we would just heed what he says here. But he says, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. They're called the sons of God because they're doing now in their lives what their father is always trying to do. And the father is always trying to make peace with you. God's not trying to make war with you. God's trying to make peace with you. He sent Jesus to die for your sins so that peace could be found. Jesus, God is totally seeking peace, and he's calling upon us to be like him, to be his sons and daughters, to be peacemakers, not troublemakers. And so if there's trouble and drama everywhere you go in life, in the voluntary organizations that you're involved with, in your relationships with people at church, in your family, if it's always drama, if there's always conflict, if there's always trouble, at some point you need to ask yourself the question, and I need to ask myself the question, who is the common denominator in all these troubles? Who's the common denominator in all the drama? Why am I always embroiled in drama? And the reason is I'm a troublemaker, not a peacemaker, and I'm a troublemaker because I'm a troubled person, and I'm in trouble because I'm not at peace with God, and until I'm at peace with God, I'll never be at peace with myself, and therefore can't be at peace with other people. And Jesus knows if you want to be happy, you've got to be at peace with him, peace with others, peace with yourself. So be a peacemaker and not a troublemaker. Jesus says, finally, in the most shocking one of all, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Now, you might say, okay, I kind of go along with a lot of these, but clearly Jesus takes it once. He shouldn't have the seven Beatitudes because he just took it one step too far here. Because there's no way that those who are persecuted, who are suffering for doing the right thing, are the happy people. But what Jesus knows that you and I maybe are overlooking, he knows that you can endure temporary pain and opposition much, much better. It has much less of an assault on your overall happiness than the pain of looking back in regret over choosing disloyalty and choosing the wrong thing. You see, adverse circumstances are painful. Jesus isn't denying that. He's not denying that. But he knows that you'll get through that. But what you won't get through is looking back and saying, I should have been there. I should have done the right thing. I should have taken my stand for what was right and true and good. And with the people who I should have had their back, but I chose the easy way out. That erodes your happiness. If you have the kind of happiness we've been accumulating through these other attitudes, when the moment of persecution comes, that persecution that you endure is not going to rob you of your happiness. So what can we say about all of these? We've got all eight of them overviewed, and I know that's a quick overview, but What can we take away from all of them? We can say this. We can learn from all of them. This is the common point. Happiness is never gotten directly. You don't ever say, I'm going to be happy and I'm just choosing to be happy. Rather, happiness always comes as a result of seeking something else. You seek the right things and the happiness comes as a result. We can put it this way. So holiness, so righteousness, so godliness, and reap happiness. That's the way that it works. Jesus knows that this is the truth, and so he teaches it to us. So that's the big idea. Here's the way Jesus puts it in his words, which are always better than mine. In Matthew 6:33, same sermon, middle of the sermon, he's gone through these attitudes, and here he says a few other things. Then he says this, this is crucial, seek first the kingdom of God. Let God reign in your life and pursue his righteousness. Pursue the things that God says are good, that God says are right. Put those things first. Make that your priority. And what? And all these things will be added to you. Everything else in life, including your pursuit of happiness, that's going to be taken care of. God's going to see to it that you harvest that if you'll sow righteousness, if you'll sow seeking him first in your life. I want to be happy. I want all of us to be happy ultimately and eternally. And I believe that Jesus has the words of eternal life, and that if we'll follow his way and make the pursuit of his kingdom, not my kingdom, his kingdom, his righteousness, not the thing that I think seems best to me, but what God says, I know that if we do that, he's leading us to a good place. He's leading us to a place where he'll take care of everything if we'll follow him. So here's the most exciting thing about this lesson. You may have come in here a little bit unhappy, but you don't have to leave that way. By God's grace, you can change. And you change to become happy the same way you change to become unhappy. You've sown unrighteousness and you've reaped misery. You've sown unrighteousness and reaped misery. And in the same way that that has happened, you can begin to sow righteousness, sow holiness, and reap happiness. And that's exciting. That's encouraging. And I want us to be encouraged in that way. You can say, I'm done with self-sufficiency. And I'm humbling myself before God. I'm done denying my sin and my brokenness or trying to say that that's what's special about me. And I'm really to confess it to God and turn away from it so he can heal me. I'm through seeing myself as the star of the stage and I'm going to serve someone else. I see that putting my happiness ahead of my holiness has only led me to misery. I understand that no more holding of grudges is the pathway to mercy for myself. And I understand that even if I have to get an internet filter, even if I have to move out, even if I have to change some relationships, I'm going to start doing the right thing consistently. I'm going to make peace a priority with God and with others. And from now on, even when people oppose me, even if I lose some friends, even if I'm mocked or made fun of or don't get the advancement that I think I deserve, I'm going to do the right thing no matter what it costs, even if it costs me everything else. Now, before we end, some of you are here this morning and you're saying, you know, I've never thought about it this way. I've never thought of it that way. Now you've got an opportunity. Now you've got an opportunity to make that change, to begin to live a new paradigm, the paradigm that Jesus sets before us in this Sermon on the Mount. But I also know that there's a lot of us here who've grown up in the church. We've heard sermons on the Beatitudes a dozen times, and you're thinking to yourself this morning, so don't turn out yet. We're almost done, but not quite. You're thinking to yourself, I already knew that. I already knew that. Good. I don't doubt that you did. I know for most of you this is very simple. And you already knew that. But here's the question. If you already knew that, if that's your reaction, here's the question you desperately need to ask yourself now. If you already knew that, then why aren't you happier? If you already knew all that, then why aren't you happier? And Jesus just keeps going in the sermon, and this is how he ends it. He's so perfect. He tells us, because knowing it isn't sowing it. Knowing it isn't sowing it. Jesus tells us that it is doing that makes the difference. It isn't knowing all that, it's putting it into practice that will result in the happiness. Here's the way Jesus says it. Everyone then, this is the very end of this whole sermon, looking back on all that he said, including that introduction of the Beatitudes, which we've looked at. He said, everyone then who hears these words of mine. We've heard those words, and most of us say, I already knew that. But Jesus says, everyone who hears these sayings of mine, he doesn't say, everyone who hears these sayings of mine and agrees with them. You may say, well, I agreed with all that. That's good. Jesus doesn't say everyone who hears these sayings of mine and agrees with them. He doesn't say everyone who hears these sayings of mine and took notes. I was there for the sermon. That's all good. But he says, he who hears these sayings of mine and does them. Does them. And that's the beautiful thing about all eight of those characteristics. They are things that you can begin doing today, no matter what your background or who you are. You can begin to implement those things today, doing what Jesus said. And here's what he says. The one who hears them and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on a rock. When we build our house, the first and most vital thing James had to say to us was, you've got to build a good foundation. This isn't the place to skimp. And we all understand that because everything else rests on that foundation. And Jesus says that the person who hears and does is the person who will be blessed. He's going to build his house, speaking metaphorically of your life, on the rock. But those who hear it, a lot of church people have heard it, but they never did it, and they're like building their house on the sand. So here's how it goes. In just a few short years, at some point in the future, and I want you to imagine this. Imagine this in your eye. You're going to have all the things that in a superficial way have brought you happiness in this life stripped away one layer at a time. Those who are elderly in this group could describe this for you far better than I could. But there's going to come a day when people aren't going to be coming and asking your opinion about everything. And people aren't going to laugh at your jokes, not because you're the funniest person in the room, but because you're the boss. So you didn't even laugh at that joke. So many of the other things, the beauty, the money, the comforts of life, the things that you've gathered around you and arranged for your comfort, the things that you think in this world are going to make me happy, all of those things are stripped away, and the storm comes. It inevitably comes for every single one of us. In that moment, when you see yourself at that future state, are you just swept away in the torrent? Because you've built your life on things that don't last and ultimately do not matter. Or have you built your life on the rock, on the Lord Jesus Christ, by hearing and doing the things that He says? And even though all those things have been taken away, you still have your joy, you still have your peace. You're still standing. That's what Jesus wants for every one of us. And if that's what you want, we encourage you to follow Him, to do what He says. And if we can help you in any way to do that, we would love to do so. I'll always stand and sing for your encouragement.
Just as I am,